And we return. It is today's Topical Current. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with University of Virginia staff psychiatrist Dr. J. Anderson Thompson. He's the author of Why We Believe in God, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. And Dr. Thompson joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to you, Doctor. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. Good to have you. You say that, quote, if you understand the psychology of craving fast food, a savory slice of prime rib or a decadent chocolate sundae, you can fully comprehend the psychology of religion, unquote. Please explain that for us, will you?
Certainly. We evolved urges for those foods, for fats and sweets, and they were crucial. And all of us carry that. That's part of the legacy of our evolution. But the original fat was lean game meat. The original sweet was ripe fruit. And the modern world creates novel creations which come from those desires, but then come back at us in supernormal stimuli. So instead of the lean game meat of the African plains, we have fat-rich hamburgers. Instead of ripe fruit, we get brownies, Coca-Colas. And I don't know about you, but I'll eat a brownie before a peach any day. and that's the basis of religion. Religion comes from adaptations, from aspects of our mind that originally evolved for other purposes, but religion creates a supernormal stimuli. It comes back at us in a much more powerful form. All of us are mammals. We have the attachment system, and when we're hurting, we look to a caretaker. Basic attachment system, and religion gives us a supernormal parent that is far more powerful than any of our regular human parents. And that's why you can, if you understand the sort of psychology of fast food, the psychology of junk food, it's the same psychology for religion.
The only thing I question is, I understand what you're saying, but generally fast food is very bad for us. Are you saying religion is bad for us?
Absolutely.
Oh. Okay. Can you explain that?
Well, I think religion gives us a false picture of who we are, where we came from. It gives us a false picture of the universe, our place in the universe. And, you know, that's just globally in general. But then, obviously, it's not particularly good for us in the very specifics of things like 9/11, in the prohibitions against stem cell research. I'm a physician. The promise of stem cell research is extraordinary. And the religious prohibitions against it are terrible. Religion certainly is not helping the AIDS epidemic in Africa. The prohibition against the use of condoms is, you know, practically genocidal in its effects, the number of deaths that will cause. So I think, you know, pretty much anywhere you turn, you can see the ill effects of religion.
But don't you think it's good for some people some of the time?
Well, if you're consoled by something that is ultimately false, momentarily it may help, but I'm not sure we want to base consolation on things that are fundamentally lies.
Tell me, Dr. Anderson Thompson.
It's Andy's fun.
Andy. How does Darwinism figure in religious beliefs?
Well, it was Darwin's idea, basically evolution by natural selection, that is the only workable explanation we have for the design and variety of all life on Earth and all plant animal life. And Darwin's idea also triggered a revolution in the neurosciences, because the mind is what the brain does, and the brain also evolved by natural selection. And the adaptations that make up our mind are the ones that can combine to create religious belief. And few people realize it, but the Darwinian revolution, and particularly the Darwinian revolution in psychology, is what ultimately has allowed us to unravel the mechanisms by which human minds generate and consume religious belief.
Darwin had been religious at one point. Was his rejection of religion directly related to his theory of evolution, or was it something else?
I think it was primarily his discovery of the idea and the discovery of how life evolved and the mechanism, and then I think just the what he saw around him. I think most people feel like the death of his daughter Annie was sort of the nail on the coffin of any religious belief.
You mentioned attachment earlier. Can we begin with attachment and our system, what it is, how it works, how it relates to religion?
We're all mammals, and mammals have what is called the attachment system, and this was mapped out in humans by a British psychiatrist, John Bowlby, and an American psychologist, Mary Ainsworth. And anybody that's interested, if they just Google, I think on Becoming Attached, Robert Caron, K-A-R-I-N, there's a wonderful article in The Atlantic from some years ago that lays it all out. And this attachment system is the basis of parent-child relationships. And the attachment system is also used in friendships, our close friendships, in our love relationships. A good marriage is based on that attachment system. But its origin is basically caretaking, parent and infant and parent. And that attachment system is one of the systems that evolved, obviously originally for other purposes, which the mind uses to generate religious belief. We generate God or gods who one of their functions is a caretaker and a sort of supernormal caretaker.
Dr. Thompson, the title of your book, Why We Believe in God, Why Do We Believe in God? Why do almost all people universally and historically had religious faith?
Well, I think it's for multiple reasons. First and foremost, we are vulnerable to it. The way our minds are designed, make us vulnerable to religious beliefs, for supernatural beliefs, and that's part of what I've tried to lay out in the book. So there's the vulnerability for supernatural beliefs. And then supernatural beliefs were very useful in group cohesion and solidifying groups, the groups that we belong to. And then religion was our original cosmology and biology. Religion was our original explanation for life and the universe and our world. And I think that's why you see its early proliferation and its, until recently, its universality.
How about when you were growing up, Andy Thompson? Were you born into a religious family and have traditional Christian training? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. My mother was from Southeast Virginia and was brought up in a Methodist church, I guess a conservative Methodist church. My father was a Scottish immigrant and was Presbyterian, and the family attended a Presbyterian church in Alexandria, Virginia, and I was brought up in that atmosphere.
And when did you begin to stray, so to speak?
I think I started questioning it. My memory is questioning it during confirmation classes and the idea of what do they call it? I'm blocking on the name now. Predestination and the concepts of predestination. Everything was predestined to happen, and I was sitting there thinking, these cruel, awful things that happen to people are predestined. What kind of God is that? I think that was the origin of it in my teenage years, or I guess early adolescent years.
Do you think we're all born theists?
I think we're all born very vulnerable to be theists.
Okay.
There's an interesting new book out by a man named Justin Barrett called Born Believers, and he lays out the mechanisms from our childhood that make us very vulnerable to be theists.
Is it genetic?
Well, it's genetic in the sense that genes build brains. I mean, genes build our brains, and we have these mechanisms that were originally evolved for other purposes that combine to create religious belief. Another way of looking at this is like reading and writing. Reading and writing is a cultural creation. We don't have reading and writing mechanisms in our brain, adaptations in our brain. We use vision, innate language, the fine motor skills of our hands. We use multiple adaptations that come together to create this cultural creation of reading and writing. Religion's the same way. There are multiple mechanisms in our minds that come together to create religious belief. And so it's genetic in the sense of the genes that control the design and structure of our brains.
We're speaking with Dr. J. Andy Thompson, and that's without a P, it's T-H-O-M-S-O-N. He's the author of Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. We're going to take a short break, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we're visiting with University of Virginia staff psychiatrist Dr. J. Andy Thompson, and he's the author of Why We Believe in God, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Dr. Thompson, tell us about how religiosity can be similar to a devotion to music.
Well, music moves us. All of us are stimulated in many different ways by music, and it looks as if one of the crucial things about our earliest religion were one of the crucial things was not the belief structure, but the nature of early religions seemed to be primarily musical. And music and dance, which were probably indistinguishable, and the movement and the music, the synchronous movement, the touching, generates enormous amounts of oxytocin, endorphins, various things in our brain that help bind us to those around us and enhance feelings of trust. And so our early religions were probably based more on music than on theology. And if you look at any religion, you still see vestiges of what is thought to be the earliest religions, which again were based on song and dance and synchronous movement.
What is the earliest evidence of God or gods?
I don't know that historical literature. One of the arguments made by Nicholas Wade, who's the science correspondent for the New York Times, he has a book called The Faith Instinct, and he makes the argument that if you look at the Kung San of Africa, the Andaman Islanders in the Indian Ocean, and the Aborigines, you see almost an identical religion. And they're the three groups in the world closest to our ancestors in Africa, the first group of modern Homo sapiens, and the religions are almost identical. And there, I think they're polytheistic. They're multiple gods who were worshipped with, again, primarily song and dance. And I think they were largely animistic. But again, I'm not an expert on that area.
So you say that ritual is a very significant part of religion.
Absolutely. It's now apparent that rituals are very crucial in boosting certain neurotransmitters in our brain that enhance our feeling of trust. If we were to take, I don't know how many people are in your office there in Florida, but if we were to take a group of people in your office and divide them into two groups and have half the group just go outside and walk around the block a couple times and have the other half go out and walk around the block in lockstep, in synchronous movement, and have both groups come in and give them these what they're called economic games. And the group that walked around just doing synchronous movement will have enhanced trust of each other, just on synchronous movement, which is part of ritual. You add in music, you add in touch, and you get basically the biotechnology of affiliation, of connection to other people, and intensifying it. And that's much of what ritual does.
Can you tell us about the mind-body split and how it's hardwired and how it causes our belief in the supernatural?
There's a term called cognitive decoupling, which is a fancy term for the following. As you've been talking to me, and as the people listening to this program have been hearing it, all of us have probably for a moment thought about a conversation we need to have with somebody later this afternoon or this evening. Even if we're listening intently and paying close attention, we can sort of decouple, we can separate out, and we can think about a complex interaction with a person who's not present. We can think about what's going on in their mind. All of us right now can immediately call up in our head, if we wish, a conversation with President Obama. I can ask you to imagine, while you're listening to me, talking to President Obama, asking him for something, imagining what he would say in return. So we take this for granted. It's part of just everyday life. But it's actually pretty extraordinary cognitive software. No other animals probably have it. Well, you can see that we can have an interaction with an unseen other. We can interact with somebody else in our mind who's not literally in front of us. Again, this is something that evolved for other purposes, but you can see how it can be utilized in religion. I can interact with a dead ancestor. I can interact with a god. It's basically an unseen other.
Right.
And this is a nice illustration of how religion is actually just one small step from everyday, ordinary mechanisms in our brain. Another aspect of this is the very anatomy of our brains. Along the midline of your brain is where you process perceptions about your own feelings, and also where you process your perceptions of other people's minds, their feelings, their wishes, their desires. It's in a completely different area of the brain, the lateral cortex, where you process your own body, other perceptions of other people's bodies. So the mind-body split is built into the very architecture of our brain. For me to think about what's going on in your mind, I don't have to have you standing right in front of me.
Right.
And that allows us to imagine souls. So you can imagine, you know, I can imagine your mind separate of your body. You can see this is the foundation of the idea of souls. It can be the foundation of the idea of a god, of a spirit. Basically, a spirit is a mind separate from a body. And that's actually the default setting of our brains. We have the capacity all the time to think about minds separate from bodies. We can right now think about what might be going on in President Obama's mind.
We have with us now Oxford University evolutionary biologist Dr. Richard Dawkins. He wrote the foreword to Dr. Thompson's book, and he's joining us from the UK. And Dr. Richard Dawkins, welcome to our Topical Currents program.
Thank you very much. I was thoroughly enjoying listening to Andy there. Very interesting.
So tell us more about the meme in the information
age. Oh, you don't want to get into that. Come on, let's talk about it. Well, all right.
I want to get into it.
Okay. In 1976, I wrote my first book, The Selfish Gene, which was mostly saying that natural selection works at the level of the gene. Different genes are favored as opposed to other genes. And the whole book was about genes, but I wanted to make the point right at the end of the book that natural selection, Darwinian natural selection, will work with anything that's self-replicating anywhere in the universe. And so somewhere, you know, in outer space, there'll be a planet where there's something that isn't DNA, that's kind of like DNA, and it's the basis for a different kind of life. But then I thought, well, maybe we don't have to go to other
Dr. Dawkins, we're having a little trouble. I think you're on a cell phone. Could you maybe reposition yourself a little bit so we'd have a better, clearer connection? Or?
Well, I'm sorry I'm on a cell phone. I was supposed to be on a landline, and it didn't work.
Right.
Is that any better?
Yes,
that's better. Before we lose you on the cell phone, tell us a little bit about you're going to be at the University of Miami for a couple of weeks as a visiting professor. What are some of the events that you'll be presiding over?
Well, I don't know. That's all being handled by the University of Miami. I'm looking forward to it very much. It's a place that Florida, I've lived in before. It's a place that I like to visit. And I'm looking forward to it very much, and I think they've got a full program for me. I shall be giving a public lecture on the science of beauty and the beauty of science. I won't tell you what that's going to be about, because come along and hear it. It's a great pleasure, by the way, to be on the air with Andy Thompson. And I just want to reiterate what an immensely fine book it is, Why We Believe in God. Because it's all very well for me to write a book showing that God is a delusion and that people are deceived when they believe in gods. But we really still want to know what it is about the brain that makes people susceptible to believing in gods. And that's where Andy's expertise comes in, and what in his book is so superb in explaining why the human brain is so vulnerable, is so set up to believe in strange supernatural things.
Professor Dawkins, you use the term, quote, bright, instead of atheist. What's behind that?
Well, I didn't. I mean, that was invented by a couple of people in California, and I signed up to it. What they were looking for was an analog of the word gay for homosexual, because the word gay has been remarkably successfully taken over by the homosexual community. And it now, its meaning has totally changed. The word gay in the English language now means homosexual. And what these two Californians were trying to do was to do the same thing for atheist, and they tried to use the word bright to mean atheist. Unfortunately, it was regarded as arrogant. It was regarded as, they kept insisting that it's not an adjective, it's a noun. We're not saying we are bright. We're saying we are bright.
But doesn't that then disparage the intelligence of those who believe?
Well, their intention was that it should not disparage their intelligence. I personally would have absolutely no hesitation in disparaging their intelligence, but that wasn't my word. It was theirs. And they explicitly disavowed any intention to disparage the intelligence.
Dr. Dawkins, what is the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science? What is the mission of that foundation?
Well, reason and science is in the mission, and we regard reason and science as being paramount for human civilization. Human civilization is under threat from unreason and the opposite of science: superstition, astrology, pseudoscience, quack, fake medicine, and of course, religion. And so our mission is to promote sound reason, skeptical reasoning, critical reasoning, and scientific thinking.
Dr. Richard Dawkins, you'll be having an event at the University of Miami March the 7th at the Bank United Center there on campus. So people can go to the University of Miami website, I'm sure, and learn more about it. And we certainly want to thank you for joining us on today's broadcast. We'll be getting back to Dr. Andy Thompson in just a moment, but let's take a short break and be back with more. And we're back. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman is today's topical currents, and we're speaking with University of Virginia staff psychiatrist Dr. J. Andy Thompson, and he's the author of Why We Believe in God. Let's take a call or two. First, we have Sebastian. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I had a quick question for Dr. Thompson. Earlier in the program, Dr. Thompson, you mentioned that that the part of the brain that's used to believe in religion, it was originally meant for something else, and I was curious to know as to what it was originally meant for. Thank you for taking my call.
Doctor?
Well, there's not just one part. There are multiple mechanisms that were originally designed for other purposes that go into generating religious beliefs. And the way to think about this is reading and writing. Reading and writing is based on multiple things. As I said, vision, innate language, fine motor skills, color detection, all sorts of things that go into reading and writing. And it's similar with religion. Religion is based on the attachment system, which we've talked about, on the capacity for cognitive decoupling. It is based on our favoring of kin. Think about the Catholic Church. The priests are brothers, the Pope is the Holy Father, the nuns are sisters. Religions utilize our kin biases. Religions utilize our what is called I'm not going to use a fancy term, but basically we're biased to overread purpose. If you ask a child what a rock is for, the child is going to say, for animals to scratch themselves. We overread purpose, so it's very easy for us to imagine an agent, a supernatural agent, who will be purposeful in the world. And in my book and in other books, all these mechanisms, there's about 20 different mechanisms which have been mapped out, which evolve for other purposes that combine to create religious belief.
What is, you've said that our cooperative and altruistic instincts are hardwired. Does this mean that we're all born good?
Yes. Yeah, we all have, we all have innate tendencies towards cooperation, because that's one of the things that makes us such a successful species, is we are so extraordinarily cooperative.
And tell us about that study with the 3-month-old infants that indicated that morality is innate.
I was just about to mention that. And again, I would encourage listeners, particularly with the modern world and the Internet, is to Google Paul Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, The Moral Life of Babies, New York Times Magazine. There's a group at Yale, child developmental psychologists, that are showing that infants as young as 3 and 6 months can make distinctions between good behavior, bad behavior, and they will actually make a distinction between aggressive behavior, which is punishing a bad person, versus aggressive behavior, which is harmful. And the essence of their work is that our moral systems are innate, and you can start to see them come online as young as 3 and 6 months. It's extraordinary research. And so the idea here is that the religion claims that we would have no morality if it weren't for religious beliefs, right. And that's just nonsense. We're born moral, we're born with capacities for goodness, for cooperation, for altruism.
And let's take another call or two. This listener in Delray Beach, it's Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just want to make a comment. Charles Darwin, as I understand it, was a Unitarian, and when I was still a Unitarian, my ministers could be either theist Unitarian, Buddhist Unitarians, or secular humanist. So there are religious faiths out there that do espouse a various realm of beliefs, anywhere from Christianity to atheism.
Yes. I'm not sure I understand your question, sir.
Oh, no, I just wanted to make it clear that there are some religions, such as the Unitarian Church, that do allow someone to be either a Christian or Buddhist and also be an atheist at the same time. Or other members might be atheists.
Okay, Paul, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
We have an emailer, Alex. He wants to ask the doctor, what is his impression of the Bible?
Well, it's great literature, particularly the King James Version, and I think it's man-made. To the idea that it's the unerrant Word of God, I think, is a myth.
In your book, Dr. Thompson, you talk about hyperactivity agency detection device. I don't understand that.
There are all sorts of clumsy, fancy names for things that are sort of everyday mechanisms. And right now, you're sitting in the studio. If you heard a loud bang, you would startle. It would get your attention, and you would startle. And your body would prepare to move and to flee. And you would assume that that bang is coming from an agent, and likely a human agent, before anything else. And so we have this hyperactive agency detection mechanism, you know, that when in doubt, assume human agency. And that's basically what it is. And so we will, for instance, we'll mistake a shadow for a burglar. We will never mistake a burglar for a shadow. We overread agency, and we particularly overread human agency. And religions utilize this. So our ancestors, if there was a terrible thunderstorm, well, the gods must be angry at us.
We have an emailer here who compares you and Richard Dawkins. She says we couldn't find anyone more arrogant or self-righteous than a true believer atheist, and that you're as bad as a staunch right-wing Christian or fundamentalist in any type of religion.
Well, obviously I would disagree. And here's the reason I would disagree. Because I think the argument is that the believers are the ones who are arrogant. Arrogant in the sense of the refusal of humility before the facts. And the facts of life, of who we are, where we came from, the nature of the universe, our place in the universe. And I would obviously submit to you that it is really the true believers, the religious, who are the arrogant ones.
Doctor, what are mirror neurons, and why is their discovery so vital to understanding religious beliefs and questions of morality?
Mirror neurons were discovered by some Italian researchers in monkeys, and they're fascinating. If you all are in the studio together, and Joseph raises his right arm, and you're looking at him, and he raises his right arm, you're watching that. And the same neurons that lift your right arm are going to light up. There's a little bit of inhibition in your frontal lobes that keeps you from raising your right arm. But as you watch him do that, the same neurons in your brain light up. Similarly, if Joe, if it's Joe for Joseph, if Joe accidentally, sticks himself with a nail in his hand and he doesn't even have to say, ouch. If you see him do that, the same neurons in your brain will light up as if you stuck a nail in your hand. You will literally, at some level, feel his pain. And this allows for, it helps us connect with each other. We literally feel each other's pain. So we are basically hardwired to be sympathetic. We don't have to learn to be sympathetic. We feel it in our bones, and we're born with those capacities.
Right.
Let's.
I want to hear how that relates to religion.
Well, religions claim that they are author of things that we have innately, and that we wouldn't have them. We wouldn't have sympathy, cooperation, altruism, morality if it weren't for religion. And they can make that claim because you and I can't be conscious of the mechanisms. These mechanisms for sympathy, for altruism, for morality are largely automatic, emotional. You can't offer an explanation for them because they're just instinctive. And so religions can very easily take credit for something that is really not theirs. And so when you hear somebody say, well, if it weren't for religion, we would have no morality, I think the evidence is now overwhelming and really incontrovertible that that's simply not true.
We're speaking with University of Virginia staff psychiatrist Dr. J. Andy Thompson, and he's the author of Why We Believe in God, A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. We're going to take another short break and be back with more.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Dr. J. Anderson Thompson. He's a forensic psychiatrist and author of Why We Believe in Gods, A Concise Guide to the Science a faith. What do you say to those who say that evolution is just a theory?
Well, I say it's a fact. I mean, and evolution is not a theory, it's a fact. And there's, again, overwhelming, incontrovertible evidence for it. And it is the only workable explanation we have for the variety, design of all life on Earth, all plant and animal life. The only workable explanation we have for our design, and the only workable explanation we have for the design of the human mind. And, I mean, that's just, I think, the bottom line. And it, unfortunately, in part because of religion, it's a real affront to many people's vanity. And they just want to say, well, it's just a theory. And it's, you know, it's really the equivalent of saying that the Earth orbiting the sun is just a theory.
Mm. Well, a theory in science is something more than just a hypothesis.
Right. Well, a theory is an explanation of a set of facts.
So the facts come first, and then the theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's move along to some calls. We've got Dan. He's in Fort Lauderdale. Thanks for your patience, Dan. Hi.
Hi. I thought it was interesting the analogy that he gave at the introduction about that we started out with lean meat and fruit, but now we have, processed food, essentially. And if I, believing in God, use that same process, I come up with the same thing, except that it's simply the inaccuracy of our religion, and that God is actually always calling us back to something closer, something more organic with Him. And even though the brownies and the hamburgers are a poor substitute, they do still give us something. I also noticed that the speaker earlier talked about the way our brains were designed. And just a statement like that, I mean, something is not designed on its own. It doesn't design itself. So, and having really, you know, yes, I believe in God. And I think that the analogy of, you know, the food, I don't think that points to, I don't believe that points us away from God. I think that should actually point us back to God, to that fresh fruit and that lean meat that is a pure relationship with God, our Creator. Thank you.
Dr. Thompson.
Okay, thank you.
No, obviously I disagree.
Mary,
but he makes one point. As he notes, it's very hard in our language not to talk about purposeful design. I said, you know, our brains are designed. And so it's very easy to say, well, designed by whom? For what? And it's very hard for our minds to get around the random nature of natural selection, the purposelessness that is the fundamental mechanism that builds these extraordinary structures.
Mary says that while there are biological reasons which may have fulminated religious beliefs and the concept of God, this does not disprove the existence of a supernatural power, or does it?
Well, obviously, I think it does. And I think it's one of the best unkept secrets around, that we're really the first generation in the history of the world that understands why and how human minds generate and consume religious beliefs. Why we create this powerful imaginary friend. And I think it's marvelous psychological science. And I think the men and women who've labored long to map it out in the late 1990s, early part of this century, deserve a lot of credit. And I think ultimately they will be given that credit. But it's out there. And it's going to be in your basic introductory college psychology textbooks probably, you know, within the next decade. It's not going to be kept a secret, so to speak, or it's not going to be kept out of your basic education.
Next up, we have Christian in Miami. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Yes. My question is that if evolution is people and organisms trending toward being our best biological selves, and if religion causes so many problems, interpersonally in society and the world, why is this tendency to believe in religion and believe in God stayed with us? If it's an evolutionary quality, what's the point? Why do we have it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, I think, again, it's stayed with us because until recently it has served some useful functions. I mean, until science really has mapped out the origins of the universe, the origins of life, basically, you know, since Darwin and the great astronomers, religion served as our only explanation for life, the universe, and I think that's one of the main reasons it survived. And then, of course, it is very useful in binding groups together, and can become, it's very useful in creating a larger identity. But it's still, you know, things stay with us that aren't particularly useful. You and I continue to have fat cravings, which doesn't help the arteries in our heart. And science is helping us try to lessen that.
Do you think it's possible for religion and science to peacefully coexist ever, or will there forever be a conflict?
I think they're not going to peacefully coexist. Science ultimately just pulls the foundation out of religion, and I think those that are trying to find a sort of a negotiated settlement are doomed to failure.
Where do agnostics fit in all this?
I suppose they're,
somewhere in the middle.
But yeah, somewhere in the middle, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. I think they want to believe in belief. They don't want to make the final step, maybe.
What impelled you to write this book, Doctor?
Well, a number of things. My son was in the World Trade Center complex, not in the towers, but in a building next door, and that, needless to say, rattled me, and I started researching suicide terrorism, and in the process of it, discovered all these books and articles that had mapped out our religious belief and the neuroscience of religious belief, and put together some talks, and they got some recognition, and then I had the opportunity to work with the Richard Dawkins Foundation, and I'm so glad you had him on the show, and I would encourage all the listeners to, if you can, go hear him when he's in Miami. It's a real privilege. Read his books. Check out the website for the foundation. And through his support, the foundation's support, Dr. Cornwell and the foundation, I had the opportunity to give these talks around the country, and they got, some of them got posted on YouTube, and one in particular, and it got a lot of hits, and some people encouraged me to take that material and to turn it into a book. And so what I thought I would do, and I did, was to turn it into a very accessible, short, brief book that lays out all this exciting science in a way that you can read it in an hour and a half maybe. It's, I hope, very clear and simple, and you know, that night if you're at dinner with somebody, you can turn around and basically tell them the hows and whys that human minds generate religious belief.
The book is called Why We Believe in Gods. Dr. Thompson, is there a website associated with you and the book that people can learn more?
I think the main website to go to is the richarddawkins.net. The foundation has got a lot of interesting material. If people are interested in my specific, obviously I'd encourage them to buy the book. It's paperback, it's cheap, it's also electronic. We came out with no hardback, it was accessible. So to get the book, if you're not a reader, if you Google Andy Thompson, INR2, it was a conference in religion, and that's the YouTube that's got the most recent version of the talk posted. And people can get the basics of the book in that talk on YouTube. It's about an hour.
INR2, did you say?
Yes, it's a conference. There's a man in Western Canada that sponsors a conference every year called Imagine No Religion.
Oh.
And this was the second one, so it's Imagine No Religion 2.
It's also on the WLRN website, WLRN.org. Yeah. Anyway, we've run out of time. Certainly want to thank you, Dr. J. Andy Thompson. His book is Why We Believe in God.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and Professor Dawkins. Appreciate it.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Paul Leary. Remember, we have free archives and downloads of past programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Rest in peace, friend, colleague, David Reuter. Tomorrow's program is with Princeton University Professor Alan Blinder. He's written After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. Perfect Storm Occurred. Now the calendar. On this day in 1564, 449 years ago, the death of artist Michelangelo in Rome at age 88. He sculpted David and the Pietà before he was 30, worked on the resplendent Sistine Chapel for 40 years. And on this day in 1885, 128 years ago, the classic American novel Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is published by Mark Twain. It opens with the line, "You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter." One more while we remember NASCAR's number 3, The Intimidator. On this day in 2001, 12 years ago, the death of racing icon Dale Earnhardt at the Daytona 500 during a last lap crash. He was a 7-time Winston Cup champion. And we leave with a thought from Mark Twain, who was called by William Faulkner the father of American literature. Quote, "A person who won't read has no advantage over one who can't read." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.